It probably seems very weird to young people today, but their parents and grandparents once practiced what to do in the event of a nuclear bomb attack. Remember air raid drills in the 50s and 60s? Either duck and cover under your desk in the classroom, or file out into the hallway, face the wall, and cover your neck with your hands to protect it from flying glass. When there was a Soviet Union, we very much feared an attack using nuclear weapons. Then the Soviet Union collapsed, and national leaders reached agreements paring back the nuclear weapons stockpiles. But nuclear weapons still exist, along with the potential for their use, and that concerns a few more people in a time when more countries choose nationalist leaders, including our guests. Kevin Martin is the president of Peace Action. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Glad to be with you.
Peace Action, based in Washington, D.C. Reiner Braun is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau, based in Berlin, and he's also in the studio with us. Reiner, good to have you here.
Yeah, good morning.
They've been brought to the Rogue Valley by Peace House for a session called U.S. Empire at the Crossroads, Start a New Nuclear Arms Race or Invest in Human and Environmental Needs. There is a second version of that this afternoon at 12:30 at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University. So, Kevin, tell us first about Peace Action and the Peace Action Education Fund.
We've been around for 60 years. This is our 60th anniversary. Founded in 1957, as the organization was called SANE at the time, which was Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy. The big concern then about nuclear weapons was above-ground nuclear weapons testing. And so we were successful in the worldwide movement at banning above-ground nuclear testing. But unfortunately, we weren't able to ban all testing at that time. And if we had, who knows, we might have gone very far towards abolishing nuclear weapons. And a quick story about that, President Kennedy at the time did a speaking tour after the limited test ban treaty was signed, and he was astonished at how grateful people were. And he said if he had known, he would have pushed harder for a complete ban on nuclear testing. So often people think that democracy or people's attitudes about these issues are irrelevant, that it's only elites that make these decisions, but that's far from true, and that's been true the whole nuclear age.
Reiner Braun, tell us a bit about the IPB, the International Peace Bureau.
The IPB was founded in 1891 as one of the consequences of the bloody Crimea War. One of the founding members was the first Nobel laureate, Bertha von Suttner, and IPB itself got the Nobel Peace Prize in 1910. IPB is the biggest international peace network. We have more than 330 member organizations in about 85 countries. We are mainly connected to two topics. One is nuclear weapons, and the second is military budget or military spending. And I think this is a very urgent topic when I'm looking to the new budget your president was presenting yesterday.
Well, and that gets us in a great launch into the discussion, because the question at the heart of your discussion today, and there was another one last night, start a new nuclear arms race or invest in human and environmental needs. And you both had a chance to take a look at the federal budget out this week. Reiner, you mentioned it first. Why don't you give us your first impressions?
It is for me not understandable that the United States, which has even the biggest military budget in the world, is making their budget higher. We are spending $1.8 trillion per year for military spending. We have about 1 billion people which are suffering by hunger every day. 10 or 12,000 children are dying. We have not enough money for education programs. No one knows how to finalize the sustainable development goals of the United Nations, or who we should pay for the Green Climate Fund of the UN. All these questions need financial support for surviving, and we are spending the money for military purposes. This does not make any longer any sense, so we need a military reduction, and I think the biggest should start. So it's urgently time that the United States, on the minimum, don't rise up their military budget, but start also with a disarmament process.
The $1.8 trillion, you mentioned that is all military spending, all countries?
These
year?
Are all countries in 1 year. These are figures by the most famous Swedish peace research institute called SIPRI. These are the figures from 2016. The new figures will come out in end of March, and we are organizing around these days the Global Day of Actions Against Military Spending. This is one of the main IPB jobs.
So if $1.8 trillion is the total, and the United States is spending about $600 billion a year, is that it? So we're about a third of the total.
Yes, and we can add that NATO, where the U.S. is the strongest force in, is spending about a little bit more than $800 billion. So the biggest spender for military money are the NATO countries and the so-called Western countries.
And U.S. spending, if you look at not just the Pentagon budget, but what's overall called the national security budget, which I would call the international insecurity budget, is more like $1 trillion a year here in the U.S. when you add intelligence, so-called secret budget that we're not allowed to know about, nuclear weapons spending. It's much more. The $600 billion is really only maybe 60% or so of it.
So this budget seems like to you, Kevin Martin, exactly what you were talking about and how you can't have both guns and butter at the same time when you want $54 billion more defense spending. And the way the budget works in America now, you're expected to produce $54 billion in other cuts, and there are lots of those in this budget.
Well, the thing is, they can't even do the math right. So, first of all, just the perspective, the $54 billion increase that Trump has proposed is about equal to the annual military budget of Russia, just the increase, the U.S. increase that they're proposing, and about the same as the U.K. And the problem is there's no real perspective or understanding about this, even in the United States. Somehow we are really ignorant about the level of our militarism, about how many foreign military bases we have around the world, about how many nuclear weapons we have. There was a survey last year asking Americans how many nuclear weapons do we have, and people thought 200 or 300. It's actually 7,000. So there's a real ignorance about these issues even here in the United States.
So do you find any valid points in the idea that America needs to be stronger militarily?
I can't imagine how much more stronger we could be, and the problem is strength or security should not be purely in military terms. A good education, health care for all, good public transit, housing, fixing our infrastructure, funding the green economy. To me, those are all things that we need for a safe and secure country, not more tanks, more nuclear weapons, more bases around the world, more drone strikes.
What about just to keep up with technology? Does either one of you think that replacing the old weaponry is worth spending a lot of money on?
You know, I think we need vice versa. When one side is starting modernizing the weapons, the other side will follow. So both sides are spending even more money for military purposes. Technology should be used for civil purposes. You know, we need a lot of technologies for solving the climate problems. We need a lot of technologies for developing waterproof systems, more water possibilities for the poor people. We have not solved the whole agriculture problems in the world. For that, we need modern technologies. So modern technologies are important, but to use them for the military purposes, this is definitely the wrong way to do.
Reiner Brown and Kevin Martin will spend the balance of the hour with us here in the Jefferson Exchange talking about their concerns about peace and trying to obtain it in the nuclear age, which seems to be ramping up again. Reiner Brown is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau based in Berlin. Kevin Martin is the president of Peace Action based in Washington, D.C. They'll be at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at the Southern Oregon University campus today at 12:30. You can join us right now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists earlier this year updated its doomsday clock and the level of threat it perceives in the world, put it at 2.5 minutes to midnight, which is the highest threat level since the mid-50s. Do you agree with the assessment, Reiner Brown?
Absolutely. It is a tragedy that the Bulletin has to do it. And let us first say the Bulletin, these are the most concerned and most famous scientists in the world. The board of the Bulletin are 12 Nobel laureates. So this is a very concerned and very serious voice. And I think we really should have it in mind what they are saying. And you look, the modernization of nuclear weapons during the next 30 years should cost in the minimum $1 trillion. But this is the money today. No weapon system was so cheap like it was announced in the beginning.
So it always costs more.
You can even say $2 trillion. That is the realistic option. And, you know, again, we need this money and, you know, more nuclear weapons, modern nuclear weapons, smaller nuclear weapons, more exact nuclear weapons, make the engagement of nuclear weapons in an attack even higher, because militaries and politicians are believing that they can use these military weapons, and that they are not any longer only for deterrence. Deterrence is bad enough. But, you know, this shows that the danger of a real nuclear war is not so far, and we have really to face this, and the Bulletin gave the right answer to the dangers we are facing.
And just to be clear, this so-called nuclear modernization program, which you shouldn't call modernization because that sounds good. We want modern things, right? Really, you should call it the new nuclear arms race, because all the other nuclear powers have said we're going to do this too. It was started under Obama, not under Trump. So people should be clear about that.
And the reasoning being what? I mean, we're talking about tactical weapons, nuclear weapons that are small enough to be used on a battlefield?
Soup to nuts. They're going to modernize, quote unquote, everything. The weapons laboratories, the warheads, the missiles, the submarines, the bombers, everything.
The rockets, the places where the nuclear weapons are lying, everything will get a new shape.
Should anyone take any comfort in the fact that there are fewer nuclear weapons now than there were at the heart of the Cold War?
I suppose, but part of the problem when you look at nuclear weapons, you have to look at the overall contours of U.S. military superiority generally. Even as nuclear weapons are such a horrible threat to the world that they should all be abolished tomorrow or by 5 o'clock today, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think there's a magic delete key for nuclear weapons that you can look at in absent the overall U.S. militarism in the world.
No, friendly speaking, there's not such a big difference if you have 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world or 25,000 nuclear weapons in the world. We saw in 1945, which happened with one or with two nuclear weapons. They destroyed these both cities totally. Until today, the Japanese people are suffering from this. In the third generation, the children has much higher cancer rate than normal is. And, you know, so that is the reality, and we have to get rid of all of them. So long one nuclear weapon exists, the danger of a nuclear weapon still exists, and this is worrying for the whole world.
Well, and just to underscore, all the nuclear weapons we have now, or most of them, are tens or hundreds or thousands of times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. So the scale of the destruction, even though there are fewer, is still astonishing.
Grab your headphones. I want to take some phone calls for you here. We'll start with Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kevin Martin and Rainer Brown.
Everyone should be listening very closely to what these two men are saying. The bottom line is, even if we modernize an arsenal, even if we make them more accurate, the problem is that nuclear weapons have come back to being a political tool, which allows us to wind up making horrible miscalculations with no chance of recovery. We need to do away with the weapons entirely. During the last two administrations, we have continually pushed the Russians again and again and again and again, and they finally responded by putting medium-range nuclear missiles in Kaliningrad. That creates a first-strike capacity that we have no chance to recover from. And the bottom line is, now that we continue to play this political brinksmanship, when we have these kinds of evil weapons floating around, we're signing our own death warrants. That's what I have to say.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate that. Rainer, he was talking about Europe. Why don't you take this up?
You know, we need no nuclear weapons anywhere. This is the main point. And, you know, when we are speaking about first strike or first use, we have to speak about the NATO strategy. And the NATO strategy includes the first use of nuclear weapons by NATO. But what we need is a nuclear weapons convention with a very detailed verification system which bans the nuclear weapons all over the world. And, you know, a sign of hope are the negotiations which are starting in the United Nations in 2 weeks to develop a ban treaty for prohibiting nuclear weapons. This is the first step in the right direction, but the bad point is that the nuclear weapons countries will not take part. So the huge majority of the governments in the world will develop such a treaty, which is really a good thing, which will make bigger pressure on the nuclear weapons countries. But above all, we have to develop much more pressure on the nuclear weapons countries, above all United States and Russia. They have to come back to the negotiation table and start negotiations about a nuclear weapons convention.
And if I can just underscore Paul's point, which was a really good one, to go a little bit farther, it's U.S. overwhelming conventional and nuclear superiority has made Russia more dependent on their nuclear weapons and is spurring proliferation. So what does that mean? American tax dollars go to fund our weapons and American foreign policy that makes America and the world less safe. So nuclear weapons have an illusion of superiority, but it actually makes the world and Americans less safe.
I didn't ask about one particular aspect of the budget as designed by Donald Trump's White House, which is the idea of cutting a lot of funding from the State Department. So diplomacy would actually take a hit as the military budget goes up as well.
They can't even do the math. So again, this $54 billion increase in the military budget, which again is about equivalent to the UK's annual and Russia's annual military budget, they've said they want to fund that by cutting diplomacy. First of all, diplomacy is one of the best guarantors of American security and global security, and also environmental programs. If you eliminate the entire budget of the State Department and the EPA, it doesn't add up to $54 billion. So they can't even do the math to get this right.
Again, we're talking to Kevin Martin, the president of Peace Action, and Reiner Brown, the co-president of International Peace Bureau, in town in Ashland, actually, to talk this afternoon about U.S. empire at the crossroads, start a new nuclear arms race, or invest in human and environmental needs. This afternoon's session at 12:30 at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union on the Southern Oregon University campus in Ashland. You can join the conversation now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. And a very action-packed week for you two to be here talking about this very subject matter, not just because of the budget, but also because of developments just this morning that I was reading about with Rex Tillerson visiting Japan and Korea and talking about the fact that there's no chance for talk with North Korea anymore, and all options are on the table, which would indicate military options as well.
Not just military, nuclear. When presidents say, or the ExxonMobil Secretary of State says, all options are on the table, not just military, it also means nuclear. I wrote an op-ed about this last week that's been published a few places. Trump actually said some good things about talking to North Korea, and there were promising unofficial talks, as they call track two diplomacy, last year, including some former U.S. officials who had been successful in the 90s during the Clinton administration in helping to freeze North Korea's nuclear and missile programs for about a decade. Those talks were supposed to continue. There were some North Korean officials supposed to come to the U.S., again, for unofficial talks, not official negotiations. And the Trump administration just a week or two ago canceled the visas. This is a real problem, and I think Trump could do something that Obama didn't do, which is at least get a pause or a freeze to the missile tests of North Korea. Trump likes to disparage everything that Obama did, and whether you agree with that or not, the Iran nuclear deal, Obamacare, New START treaty, which Trump didn't even know what it was, but when he was told about it, he said, oh, that was a bad deal, that was Obama. Here's something he could do that Obama didn't do: negotiate with North Korea to get at least a pause or a freeze to stop their missile programs, which are very much of concern to people in the region.
Reiner, do countries say one thing in public and another thing in private? I mean, would Rex Tillerson, for example, be saying, you know, all options are on the table with North Korea while there are attempts going on to go through back channels diplomatically?
You know, we should have a look at through the whole region. Then we see how dangerous is the situation. I think this is the only region in the world where all nuclear weapons countries are coming together. The nuclear weapons countries from NATO, the United States, Russia, China, North Korea, India, and Pakistan. So this is one of the most dangerous regions. And to play with the discussion about options, I think this is more than dangerous. When you really want to have international security politics, you need discussion on one side with North Korea, but you also need discussion for the whole regions to solve the big amounts of problems which are in these regions. You know, there are all these trade ways, there are discussion about the islands, there are conflicts between India and Pakistan. When you start playing with the military option, the end could be really a big war. So we are really facing a very dangerous situation and should be very, very careful with wording. The only word which should permanently put on the table is the word negotiations and dialogue.
And just to say really quickly, in terms of regional concerns, regional nuclear weapons free zones have been very successful. The entire southern hemisphere is a nuclear weapons free zone. And that's why in the past it has been very important to look at some of these dynamics regionally.
How do you begin to talk to a place like North Korea where it just doesn't appear that they play by the rules of the rest of the world in terms of how they conduct themselves with other countries?
Well, the fact is their pursuit of nuclear weapons, while we don't like it, is entirely logical. When you see that North Korea is surrounded by countries that are much more powerful militarily, economically, diplomatically, especially militarily. I don't want North Korea to have nuclear weapons. I don't want anyone to have nuclear weapons, but it's entirely logical. Now, in terms of what you would get for a first step, it's actually not rocket science. If the United States and South Korea would cancel our very provocative war games, North Korea might well agree to pause their missile tests. And they have floated that in the past, and also China has suggested this recently, and Trump discarded it. If you also started to talk at least about a permanent peace treaty to replace the supposedly temporary armistice in 1953 at the end of the Korean War, that's actually something very important to North Koreans and South Koreans. So it's actually not rocket science to see how you could make some progress.
Go ahead, Reiner.
Never forget, why could the United States attack Iraq 2001, 2003? Because they had no nuclear weapons. That was the consequence of the attack on Iraq was for North Korea very simple. We need nuclear weapons that we will not be attacked by the United States. This is their deep belief. And so long there will be no negotiations about a politics of common security, common interest in security of both sides, there will be no solution of the problems. And Korea will go on with their nuclear developments, and the United States will shout about that. So we need another way. And the another way could only be to accept that North Korea is not our friend, that North Korea is economically and by their constitution an undemocratic state, but we have to negotiate with an undemocratic state to find more, to develop more security in the world. You know, this was the background of the security system in Europe in the 70s. You know, we were negotiating with the Soviet Union and the East Bloc. They were our ideological enemies. But negotiation for common interests, this makes Europe much safer, and which was the background for the possibility changes at the end of the 80s. So when we are not going this way again, we will come to a confrontation which leads us to a big war.
Am I correct, Kevin Martin, in perceiving there's a fair amount of macho stuck in here, too, particularly when it comes to things like who stops the war games or the missile tests first? It's like, no, you stop first. No, you stop first.
I do, and it's very sophomoric as far as I'm concerned. And part of it also is who gets the credit. But in the end, everybody should get the credit. And that's one of the great things about diplomatic successes is at the end, everybody's happy, everybody gets the credit. I do think, though, Trump, you know, you should take him at his word that he's a deal maker. Well, he has a chance to do a great deal that's not just about real estate or making profits. This could benefit not only regional but global security.
We are again talking about nuclear weapons and global security and how to get rid of one and have more of the other, and particularly how do we arrange things like budget priorities. Kevin Martin is the president of Peace Action. Reiner Brown is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. They're in Ashland for a chat this afternoon at 12:30 on the SOU campus. We'll resume our conversation after the break. You're welcome to join us. Phone calls, 800-838-3760. Emails, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. And I'll let you know that you can find us online at jeffexchange.org. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, and you can take part in the program as it happens. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And we're spending this hour talking about nuclear weapons. They still exist, albeit in smaller numbers than a few decades ago. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists recently set its doomsday clock at 2.5 minutes to midnight, the highest alert level since the mid-50s. We're visiting with Kevin Martin, the president of Peace Action. He's based in Washington, D.C. Reiner Brown is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. He's based in Berlin. They are both in Ashland, sponsored by Peace House, for speaking engagements on U.S. Empire at the Crossroads, Start a New Nuclear Arms Race, or Invest in Human and Environmental Needs. They have the second of two sessions this afternoon at 12:30 on Southern Oregon University's campus at the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room in Ashland. You can join us now in the exchange again, 800-838-3760. Email jx@jeffnet.org. Reiner, obviously you live in Europe. You bring the European view here. Let's talk about the mood in Europe about Donald Trump and his talk about dropping out of NATO, or at least requiring more from NATO.
You know, friendly speaking, Trump would not be elected in Europe. He had really no chance, even when we have right-wing parties all over Europe. But they are in the percentage between 15 or not more than 20%. So that is the good point. The bad point is that Europe is following the militarization strategy of the United States. Above all, they accept by the two last NATO summits the 2% GDP development of the military budget. This means 2% of the GDP of the different countries should be paid for military purposes. This means for my own country, Germany, we are now spending $37 billion, and it should be raised up to $65 billion. This will not happen without cuts by education, environmental purposes, and social welfare. So this is, again, a very dangerous development. And, you know, I cannot imagine how the weakest countries in Europe, like Greece, or like Italy, which has debts from more than 1 trillion, no, $100 trillion should pay these military budgets. This is without any chance. But this is the legal option. They signed it. And, you know, today the meeting between Merkel and Trump, and I think both will at the end agree again that this is the aim they want to follow up. This is definitely the wrong way. So the NATO development in Europe is in general absolutely the wrong way, because NATO was going during the last 25 years to the east. All the East European countries were becoming member of NATO against the spirit of the so-called Charter of Paris, which was ending the Cold War era and was calling for a Europe of cooperation and dialogue, signed by all European countries, United States and Canada. So Europe is, it's a pity I have to say, is following on a smaller stage the U.S. way to more militarism.
You know, when the call we had earlier referenced the American and NATO missiles in Europe aimed at Russia, I almost called it the Soviet Union. Whoops, back in time. But the fact is that there are armaments that are close physically to Russia. In a similar situation, the United States would clearly freak out if there were armaments placed in Mexico or Canada, for example. So,
Cuban Missile Crisis,
mm-hmm,
right?
Exactly.
That's when I was born. My mother thought I might not be born, so it's not hypothetical.
So then, I mean, how do you reduce that level of tension? I mean, particularly as we pointed out, there's a bit of macho-ness that goes on here. Well, as well, like, we need to look strong, so you're going to need to look strong, and on it goes.
Well, all of the U.S. nuclear weapons should be removed from Europe. They're in five countries, and they are very provocative. Unfortunately, they're being modernized. They're modernizing the warheads, which is the exact wrong way to go. And without in any way supporting or endorsing Vladimir Putin or Russia's militarism or the problems that Russia has with lack of democracy, human rights, environmental problems, it's understandable to see how they would feel sort of beleaguered with NATO expansion, with missile defense, and really facing a Western bloc that seems very hostile. So I don't endorse anything that Putin is doing militarily, but it's kind of interesting, or it's kind of, you can understand why it is. And who knows if Trump has whatever convoluted relationship he has with Russia or Putin. Put that aside for a minute. You have to be very concerned that the military-industrial complex, the war machine, whatever you want to call it in the United States, has a vested interest in having an enemy. It's got to be Russia or China. There's really nobody else that would justify our continuing to spend so much on the military and on modernizing nuclear weapons. The point is, that's not in the interest of the American people or the Russian people or the Chinese people.
How concerned are either of you that both Russia and the United States now have ground troops in Syria?
Very concerned. It's a horrible problem. And if anything, that's where the U.S. and Russia and some of the other actors should have common interests, common security interests in getting together to help solve the problem, the horrible problems in Syria.
Let's come back to Europe again, though. I mean, would European countries end up spending more if the United States spent less?
Definitely. You know, this would be door opener. I think no government in Europe can present a higher military budget to their people and even to the parliament when the United States starts a disarmament process. Or better to say, when the world starts a disarmament process. Because, you know, also China and Russia need their financial resources for other purposes. Russia is a quite poor country, so there is a lot of modernization necessary in Russia. So we definitely need a worldwide process of disarmament. But, you know, we have the opposite. We have now 763 U.S. military bases around the world. When you look to the map, two-thirds of these military bases are either around Russia or around China. What should these countries think about that? So this is obviously that the militarism in these countries will rise up when the United States will not change their politics. And this is the main thing we have to work for.
I want to make some lines clear here, too, that the complaints about the approach to military strategy are not just related to President Trump. I know peace action was fairly hard on President Obama, too, wasn't it?
Yes. A lot of people thought that he was going to be more peace-minded than he was. I was always skeptical. I couldn't believe when he got the Nobel Prize, mostly for making a speech about nuclear disarmament. You don't get the Nobel Prize for medicine for making a speech about curing cancer, do you? You got to actually make progress towards curing cancer.
You know, let me say this. We had a big hope in Europe, in Obama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we were very convinced about his speeches in Prague and in Cairo about abolishing of nuclear weapons, even when he said, not in my lifetime. It was a chance for opening a new door. But we were also very disappointed, above all, about his drones politics. You know, these illegal drones actions all around the world, were, for what they were, misusing the U.S. airbase in Ramstein, because all drones have to be reconfirmed in Ramstein before they are coming to the different goals in the world. This makes a big, big change in the general opinion to Obama. This, I think Obama was at the end going the wrong way, and one of the big wrong decisions made by European Parliament, by the Norwegian Parliament, was to give the Nobel Peace Prize to Obama. For what? For nothing. You know, you should get the Nobel Peace Prize at the end of your life for what you have done. And he has not done anything at that time, and later he has done even the wrong things.
Well, and I think it showed a bit of a desperation, which was understandable after the 8 years of Bush and Cheney. But just to stay on this for a minute, because particularly in U.S. politics, we get very wrapped up in personalities, which is understandably so. And again, just look at the last few presidents we've had. It's understandable why that is. But I think there's a real problem of our not understanding the sort of constant nature of militarism. The United States has been at war for all but 17 or 18 years of our history, going back to 1776. We're coming up on an incredibly important to me, and I think to a lot of people, anniversary. Coming up April 4th will be the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's speech, where he talked about the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation or extreme materialism. Now, on the one hand, you could be depressed and say, my gosh, it's 50 years later and we still haven't done very well in overcoming those giant triplets. On the other hand, it's a great framework for people that care about the common good to say that these things are linked, they're pernicious, they really infect our society, and our struggles to overcome them, to overcome racism, militarism, and economic exploitation also need to be linked.
We have an email here from Richard. I'm not sure what town he comes from. He says, if two street fighters with black belts in karate agree that they won't use their martial art in case of a fight, both would be foolish to trust the promise would be kept. I know your guests would speak of inspection, but silos are hidden from even satellite inspection by their being deep underground. I would like to find that Mr. Martin speak to the dictators in North Korea, Russia, and Pakistan and their populations about nuclear missile disarmament. Then if they agree, America could support Mr. Martin's point.
Talk is better than war, as Winston Churchill said. And it's about what do you think, again, is making for a more secure United States or a more secure world. And I don't think it's more weapons. I don't think it's more nuclear armaments. And I don't think especially it's the opportunity cost, where you put so much money into the military that, you know, the infrastructure in this country is crumbling. Reiner can talk about this. And I think a lot of people are so myopic in the United States. The level of economic development in this country now is falling behind some of the richest countries in Europe, because Europe doesn't spend so bloody much of their money on the military. So I don't have no truck. I have no sympathy for Putin or Kim Jong-un or whoever, but that's not the point. Okay, the point is what's going to make the world safer, and it's not brimming with armaments. That's not a safer world.
Well, let's talk about that infrastructure. That's a great point to pivot on, because Germany does, in fact, have high-speed highways and great fast trains and good airports and a lot of the things that we talk about America wanting to get if we spend some money on infrastructure. Does it have those things in large part because it spends public money on that instead of on armaments?
You know, we have a totally other social and environmental and infrastructure system in Europe. We are believing that the state has a deep responsibility for developing the country and the social welfare, the infrastructure and the environment and the education. This means people in our country are willing to spend more money for these purposes. And this is, for me, always a huge change when I'm coming to the United States to understand the different traditions and the different feelings, how a society should be developed. This is a big progress. But, you know, on the other side, we have a lot of very poor countries in Europe. I'm not only speaking about Greece, but we can speak about the East European countries. We can also speak about Portugal or Spain or Italy, which are in deep economic crisis. So we need any penny or any cent in European money for developing our economy, for changing our economy to make it much more green. You know, we have the same problem like you. We have to reduce our emissions tremendously. Otherwise, we will never solve the climate problem. We have to come to a new infrastructure system. We have to really to go away from the car systems. You know, the day-to-day use of car is not any longer responsible. I say this in the United States, where I know that people are loving their cars. But this is will be not the future, but a public transport system must be very convenient for the people. You should not wait very long for the public transport. It should come in time. It should be very cheap. So these are the challenges we are facing. And for that, we need any penny we are spending for military purposes now.
Well, and one of the big problems, and people have studied this over time, in the United States, one of the reasons why we are so anti-tax is we just don't see as much benefit. And part of that is because so much of our taxes goes to the Pentagon. And I'm not being anti-military here. I have a lot of veterans friends, military friends. My father and uncle were in the Air Force. But if you ask people, would you pay higher taxes for better schools, roads, bridges, airports, et cetera, they always say yes. So there is a commonality between Europe and the United States in that way. The problem is you have demagoguery around taxes in this country, and taxes have actually become an issue apart from what they fund. And it's bizarre to me that just taxes are bad. We hate taxes. We're anti-tax. Well, what are they funding? If they're funding more wars and the Pentagon spending, and I don't see that benefit in my community, well, then of course I'm anti-tax. I would gladly pay better taxes, more higher taxes for better schools, and so would most Americans.
Kevin Martins is with Peace Action. He's the president. Reiner Braun is the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. We have a couple minutes left here on the Jefferson Exchange with them. I have seen some commentators say something that has crossed my mind, too, that may be part of the reason that we seem to have a renewed interest in nuclear weapons and militarization and even people rising as dictators in different parts of the world is because the people who remember World War II are by and large dying off now.
Not in Russia. I mean, that's the thing. Okay, the people themselves are dead, but Reiner makes this point all the time, and I certainly learned this when I went to Russia. You know, the searing memory of 27 million it was?
Yeah, 27 million.
Dying in Russia out of a population of about 150 million. The price that they paid in World War II is beyond anything that people in this country or in Europe can understand.
You know, I think we don't have this in Europe or in Germany. You know, there is the grand parents are giving this to the parents to the children. Our young generation have in mind that we have a totally destroyed country in 1945, that there was no stone on the other, and that we have to rebuild this. And before that, the nights in the cellar or the nights waiting when the bombers are going away, this will be never forgotten. And, you know, the anti-war climate in Germany, 80% of the Germans are against interventional politics of our government. 90% are against nuclear weapons. So this is the consequence of our history. You know, Germany was responsible for two wars. We never want this again. So there is a deep, deep peace feeling, which is the background also for quite good work of the peace movement. So I think we have not forgotten that. The problem is that the United States always was so far away from the dirty, bloody wars that they really maybe don't reflect very personally for the majority of the people what war really means. What does it mean to be killed every second or every day?
So in a world where you seek to get the reductions of nuclear weapons and maybe have some countries not have them anymore, how does that process start with the likes of, say, North Korea, which, as you pointed out, Kevin, is surrounded by countries that do have nuclear weapons, concerned about South Korea, concerned about the United States helping South Korea. I don't see India or Pakistan wanting to give up their nuclear weapons when the other has nuclear weapons. So how do you get this process rolling?
So I think there are two main points about this. And again, to go back to what I said earlier, while nuclear weapons pose an unacceptable threat to life on the planet, it can't be divorced from the larger question of militarization. So if you have a country that has the capacity to be more reliant on nuclear weapons because they face a conventional superior adversary, they're going to do that. And so again, that's how U.S. military policy actually encourages proliferation, which seems counterintuitive. The other thing, though, is to look at either regional solutions or global solutions. And as Reiner talked about, it's historic that the United Nations General Assembly is going to begin negotiations for a treaty to ban nuclear weapons at the end of this month. Reiner and I will both be at the United Nations in New York. Then the real next big round will be in June and July. Now, the nuclear states are not going to sign on to that treaty. It will be a bunch of countries that don't have nuclear weapons saying we need a treaty. North Korea actually abstained in the vote in the General Assembly, which was kind of interesting. And India and Pakistan have actually made a few, I wouldn't say the clearest signals, but a few notions that they might participate. participate or might be open to getting rid of their nuclear weapons. However, it doesn't get far down the track before you say, well, what about the U.S.? What about China? What about Russia? So you do, in the end, need a global ban on nuclear weapons.
But, you know, let's start with the deals. Maybe Trump and Putin make a deal and reduce the 1,500 nuclear weapons both sides has to maybe 500. This would be a big step forward. And then we can think to have negotiation with all the nuclear weapons countries, because then all have quite the same level of nuclear weapons. Because, you know, there is no sense for Pakistan to negotiate when the U.S. and Russia has 1,500 nuclear weapons. You know, second point is we could enlarge the nuclear weapon-free zones in the world. And maybe the next step could be a nuclear weapons-free zone in Europe. Why should Great Britain and France have nuclear weapons? For what? This makes militarily no sense. So this could be a political step forward.
Well, and the five countries that have U.S. nuclear weapons on their soil in Europe
as
well.
And, you know, the third would be all the nuclear weapons should go home to the countries, to them their own. So this means a nuclear weapon-free zone in Europe, exclude U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe. So I'm very open to think about next steps which could be done on the long pathway till to a nuclear weapons convention. You know, we have experience with these conventions. We have the two other weapons of mass destruction are forbidden by conventions, chemical weapons convention and biological weapons convention. Why not have a nuclear weapons convention at the end, but start with the first step? I think somewhere in spring, Putin and Trump will meet and they can agree about starting negotiations for reducing the nuclear weapons of the United States and Russia. And maybe they could be following an agreement by NATO to stop the so-called modernization process as a symbol of hope and a symbol that negotiations could be successful.
And just to be clear about that, the importance of the U.S. and Russia still, we have between us 93% of the world's nuclear weapons still, 93%. which is not to say that the other countries aren't also an issue, but it's 93% still of global nuclear arsenals in Russia and the United States.
The system seems to be so immune to change, though. And here we get into President Eisenhower's declaration of a military-industrial complex. Kevin, you mentioned the fact that things have stayed fairly steady through presidents of both parties. So there is this constant push, and we've talked many times on the program about the fact that weapon systems are generally built in multiple states, multiple congressional districts. That gives you a number of members of Congress fighting for the F-35, for example.
Even Bernie Sanders, who people thought was a big peacenik, supports the F-35 because they want to base it in Burlington. I think there are two main points about that. First of all, I don't think we should be governed by fear, but that's all they have. The warmongers, the war machine, the right wing, that's all they have is fear. And I think we need to talk about a beloved community. What do we really need to make our lives better? Do we really believe in the common good? President Trump actually used that phrase in his speech to Congress. I couldn't believe it. If I had been watching, I probably would have snorted something out of my nostrils when he says the common good, because he doesn't believe in the common good, but at least he had to say that. I think that's really what it comes down to. Do you believe in the common good or don't you? If you do, you don't think we should spend more money on war and nuclear weapons. I think that's a very simple premise.
Reiner Brown, do you see anything coming out of this meeting at the White House today with Angela Merkel and Donald Trump?
No, it's a pity, but I have to say I cannot see many positive signs from these meetings. You know, I'm very interesting because there will be meeting two personalities with a very different culture. So that may be an interesting point, but I think there will be agreements in the wrong direction of more militarism in Europe and the United States. And you know, to say to make Germany and U.S. stronger is not an answer to the problems of the world. We need a common, strong world. And this means, above all, a peaceful world. And this means we have to change away from the military budgets in the world.
We can sneak in one final phone call in the minute we have left. Kara and Eugene, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I saw you guys speaking, Eugene. I had an idea about how to help start, support the citizen-to-citizen social movement across countries. You know how you can, Skype how we Skype with my friends and family? Sometimes I sit down to dinner and Skype with my son who's having dinner in Canada. If you could find German people and even peace groups, Russian people and peace groups that would Skype, and we eat dinner together over Skype to get to know each other a little. There's the idea.
All right, thanks, Kara. Appreciate that.
Let me answer this a little bit more generally. What we definitely need much more is people's diplomacy. We need, again, much more context between so-called normal people all around the world. And I really would say we need this above all between people from the United States and Russia. This is the background that also the politics will change.
I love it. And I'll make borscht. I make a really good borscht. And so the Russians would love that to Skype and watch me making and eating borscht.
Skype and a meal from Kevin Martin, the president of Peace Action based in Washington. Reiner Braun, the co-president of the International Peace Bureau. He's based in Berlin. They speak this afternoon at 12:30 on U.S. Empire at the Crossroads. Start a new nuclear arms race or invest in human and environmental needs. It ends in a question mark. That's 12:30 at the Rogue River Room at the Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University. I want to thank them both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Gentlemen, good to have you.
My pleasure. And I just want to say thanks to Peace House here in Ashland, our associate group that has helped to coordinate our tour here in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you for inviting us.